Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Right Minds podcast. It is the 30th of April 2019. I am your host, Dewey De Boer. Your usual co-host, Jesse Anderson, has been taken ill today, but he does send his regards to his many dozens of doting fans. He hopes to be back next week, and we wish him a speedy recovery. Instead, our planned mystery guest will be co-hosting with me. He goes under the moniker of Oregon. How are you doing?
I am well, thank you. Good evening, and good evening to all the Right Minds listeners. I hope you're well.
We usually start off the podcast by following up on some developments from the previous episode. And last time, Jesse and I talked a bit about Simon Bridges and his capital gains tax issue, which had been taken away. And we were wondering, what is Simon Bridges going to talk about now? Because capital gains tax was the only thing he was really interested in. And we found out what it is.
Slushy machines.
Slushy machines in prisons. So, do you think there is he's holding a winning hand here with the $1 million slushy machines?
No, certainly not. And just out of respect to the corrections staff, they work actually quite hard and they deal with some of the worst and most undesirable people in our society. And I have some experience of working amongst corrections folk, and some of the things that they are often subjected to are assaults, threats to their lives and to the lives of their family, and numerous occasions they get effluent slung at them through the bars of and the openings in their cells. So it's not a nice job, and considering some of the things that they have to put up with, it does get quite hot in the prisons, and they have to wear a stab-proof vest. And these people have families, man. Like, they want to be able to go home to their kids. And, you know, people do get stabbed in prisons. In fact, there was a very recent case in Pirimarimo prison where one of the staff was assaulted. The officers actually took a little bit of revenge on the perpetrator, the inmate who was currently in prison. And funnily enough, the union didn't actually come to the party and defend them, which was interesting. So of all the fights that Simon Bridges could pick, of all the topics that he could challenge the current government on, slushy machines is probably the lowest, most abject grasping of straws that one could summon as an MP.
The biggest complaint that I would have, I would say, great. I mean, prisons should have slushy machines, probably, but the cost is maybe a little bit high. Yeah. But we're talking $1 million here in terms of government waste. Hmm. There are a lot of things that the government is wasting a lot more than $1 million on. Say, for instance, $1 billion for one particular MP,
yes,
in his own slush fund.
Yes.
And there are, just today or yesterday, it had been revealed that he was giving, going to give $15 million to certain airlines that hadn't even requested for money. So there you go, you got $15 of wasteful spending. That's just happened in the last day Shane Jones's regional development slush fund. Yeah, we're seeing Simon Bridges pick weird battles.
Yeah.
And so we have spent like almost every episode of this podcast criticizing him. And the other rumor going around for Simon Bridges is that someone's going to roll him. And Judith Collins comes up as the primary name there.
Yeah,
Do you think Judith Collins is actually going to do it? Because last time that Jesse and I talked about who's going to replace Simon Bridges, I said they don't really have someone who could replace Simon Bridges and defeat Jacinda, at least as far as I can see. They don't have someone who's going to stick the right issues on Jacinda to begin with.
Well, I think the mere fact in using, I hate to use this term, but the social justice lens, that Judith Collins is a woman, so she has that in her favour. She's been tough on crime, so it does appeal to many of the National Party body of voters. And I think she is articulate enough to engage the voting populace. I wasn't particularly impressed with her in the gun debate as it went before.
Was it a select committee oral hearing?
She kind of like threw a bunch of her whatnot supporters, but people who would be sympathetic to her cause, under their bus by sort of trampling all over their rights. Yeah, so I'm not 100% for Collins, yes, but I think she would be the strongest contender.
I believe there were a lot of people who were more for Collins before what happened.
Yeah,
you know, in the last month. I mean, we will have to see what happens. I Yeah, I'm struggling at this point to predict if Collins would do better than Bridges. That I'm not actually willing to go on the record there.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Are you? You think that she will do better than Bridges?
Yeah, I think she would.
And do you think she will roll him? The answer to the question is: Simon Bridges disappearing for the next election? I'm of the opinion that it's probably not the best idea, and that it's you're starting off a sort of a losing. You're playing a losing hand to begin with against a very popular prime minister.
Yeah, if he were to attack the flaws in the current government, like, he should be able to win the next election, but he's just not targeted and focused enough on the issues at hand. Like, you know, it's slushy machine, case in point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a spurious thing to bring up, really. Mm-hmm.
The other story that's had a lot of development since we covered it last week was Brian Tumaki and his, I used the word crusade at the time, we may come back to that later on, but he's sort of gone to war against the government in what's turning out to be quite an escalating battle, where he's gone so far as to suggest that there may be riots in prisons if he doesn't get his demands met. Said, quote-unquote, that he has been gang-raped by the cabinet, by the Prime Minister's cabinet, since they've ganged up on him.
Yeah, unbelievable. Hyperbole much?
Yeah. And that's... We focused last time on his passionate defense of Christianity that he's doing. Now he's shifted gear. He's got the focus, kind of, and he shifted it to his program, and he's decided that he's got the media attention, and he's going to be keeping it. What's he going to do with it?
Yeah, well, there is a hidden agenda with Brian Tumaki. So I've heard through the grapevine that currently his Man Up program, which is to rehabilitate various offenders, like gang offenders, people from the gangs, through a Christian-based program, or at least Christian from the perspective of Tumaki et al. And the Department of Corrections isn't a fan of it. It's not a supported program. So when this program comes before the court, so if an offender arrives at court and they say that they've done the Man Up program in terms of addressing their reoffending risk factors, it is not accepted by the court, and rightly so, because there is no accountability. The only accountability is from the coordinator of the various regional program. So Brian Tumaki, what I've heard through the grapevine, is actually seeking funding from the Department of Corrections to have this program funded. He claims that there is a lot of success through the program. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I suspect, you know, the attacks, especially when he's specifically targeting the MPs, mm-hmm. the politicians.
Yeah, members of cabinet specifically.
Members of cabinet. I haven't heard the news today, so okay. I'm not familiar with exactly what he said. But I suspect that that's part of his agenda, that his drive to get this program funded by the government, mm-hmm. the Department of Corrections.
I was wondering why he needed to have his program funded. Why does the taxpayer need to foot the bill? But you're saying the reason the taxpayer needs to foot the bill is so that it can be taken into account with sentencing and reductions in sentencing.
Yeah.
That, so sort of bail, parole.
Probation.
Probation hearings. Yeah. And that needs to be, and only taxpayer-funded programs are actually accepted. So in order for something to be recognized, it will be funded.
Yeah.
So it's not just the funding, it's the accepting.
Yeah.
It's to get it accepted.
Of the whole program that he's developed and that he's presenting.
That's very interesting, because I always read the headlines, it's all about funding. He's after money, but it seems like he's actually after the legitimacy of the program.
Yeah.
I don't think we've got very much more to say on that topic at this point, but it's something we will keep an eye on, likely, and it's likely something that's going to resurface in the coming weeks. It's just something interesting to keep an eye on and see where it leads.
Yes.
We shall see. Now, before we switch into the reason that you were invited to come on to this program in the first place, we'll cover the sort of the last big story, kind of two stories that are intertwined. We've had 11 guns stolen from a police station in New Plymouth.
Yes.
One of those had been returned, handed in by a member of the public. So he had removed it from his secure storage, put it into the police storage, and now it's sitting somewhere with a gang member. So that's excellent optics for the government right there.
Yes.
And the related story to that is, of course, that there's supposedly a list of 100 people who are tracked by police.
Mm.
And part of that list has been leaked to the media. So we've got some privacy issues. We have some real issues with the police not storing physical items and not storing digital items correctly either. So this is looking like a really bad blunder for the police.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a total degradation of the integrity of the police officers that are responsible for the handling and storage of those weapons. I suggest that somebody's head will probably roll in regards to this, given the gravity of the Christchurch mosque shootings.
Yep. And, of course, the legislation that they rushed through it undermines everything they've done.
Yep.
The police minister himself claimed that the firearms would be stored more securely by the police than they are being currently stored by the owners.
Yeah.
And now the police have had to do a huge 180 to say, actually, the owners, you're going to have to hang on to them for much longer than we thought you were.
Mm-hmm.
They're more secure in your hands, even though they're illegal for you to have.
Yeah.
So it's a prohibited item for you to have, but you must hold on to it because we can't take it off you. And that goes to show just how much of a joke the firearms legislation is.
It's right? A total joke.
That because these items are so dangerous that the people who have them need to hold on to them. we're laughing, we should be crying.
No, really. I was speaking to my doctor about this, of all things, and he used to be a doctor for the forces, just to try and be a bit unspecific there, but the forces, the armed forces. And he suggested that the guns be stored in an army base, because they already store weapons at army bases. And, it's a secure facility, it's fenced off, and they have far greater capacity to store weapons in terms of the space as well. And also the weapons would be centralised. I'm surprised no one in Parliament has thought of that.
Mm-hmm. It's a great suggestion. There could be some politics going on. There could be some conflict behind the scenes that we're not aware of.
It seems strange that such a small nation that there would be that sort of politics behind the storage of weapons. You know, it's not like it's a really large country with larger systems.
Again, this is a story that's going to develop every week or every few weeks. We'll probably have an update here and more angles to discuss.
And what was the other topic?
The 100 people that they're tracking. And who's on the list? Apparently some members of the media know. I saw Vinnie Eastwood, who apparently, for people who haven't heard of Vinnie Eastwood, he's sort of New Zealand's most popular sort of independent journalist.
Yeah, I'd say he's like the New Zealand equivalent of Alex Jones.
Mm. I don't know if he's going to find that insulting or...
I think I've watched Vincent Eastwood for quite some time, probably back to 2008. I don't follow him so much anymore, but he's always been interesting and humorous, and he's had a lot of guts, and he's covered a lot of topics that people otherwise wouldn't cover.
And that's sort of why he came to my attention. I hadn't heard much of him before, a couple of weeks ago, and he supposedly mentioned us, probably because I referenced him being visited by the police 5 times in the space of a week. And anyway, journalists were ringing him up, he said, and saying, are you on the list? And his response was, I sure hope so.
Are you on the list, Stuart?
I don't know. I would be flattered, but I would also be concerned with the list itself if I were on the list.
Yeah.
And same thing with Vinny, actually. If Vinny is on the list, it would show just how much of a joke the list is.
Do you know what is a joke? And that's stuff. You guys are just juveniles. You are like little children who are hiding lollies from their cohort and going, ha, ha, ha. We have this, but we're not going to tell you what it's all about. You know, it's pathetic. It truly is pathetic.
And it's potentially criminal, too, because if they were allowed to, let's say if they did release the list, you've got problems of even criminal liability that they've just put people's names out there, put them in danger, who knows what else, all kinds of implications with regards to privacy. And if it is a serious list and it's okay for them to release the name, them not doing it is, like you said, childish. So either they're being childish or they're being, they're verging on something quite nefarious.
Yeah.
And we don't know which one that is because we don't know who's on the list, right? If you were to know who's on the list, you'd know whether the list is a joke or not.
Yeah. And that's why the whole coming out with it, but not being able to give any details is actually just truly pathetic.
Absolutely.
I just read it and I was just like, it's like a facepalm moment for me.
Like, we don't have enough things going on in the country right now to be covering seriously.
Exactly.
Well, that's really all of the main weekly news that I wanted to cover. And the reason we were going to have you on the show, and this would have been more of an interview, but now that you're co-hosting, I'm just going to sort of hand this over to you and you're going to tell me, why did you ask to come on the show?
Well, look, I've got a bit of a bugbear with Peter Lynham. So Peter Lynham is a New Zealand academic who's recently retired. He's been associated with Massey University, and he's about as left as they come.
All of the really terrible professors seem to come from Massey University.
Yeah.
We've had all of this free speech issue around Don Brash being blocked from Massey. We've got the supposed quote-unquote alt-right expert Paul Spoonley, who knows absolutely nothing about anybody who's
deranged.
just weird. Yeah. Weird. He's always cited as the expert on the alt-right. he can't tell left from right from center to begin with.
Yeah.
And all of these people, they all come from Massey University. They've got a real problem at Massey University they need to sort out.
Well, Peter Lynham, just this is in regards to the Crusaders' name. Crusaders, as most of the listeners are probably aware, they've come under a lot of pressure to change the name from the Crusaders. Peter Lynham has come out and basically got stuck into the Crusaders, saying that they never should have been named the Crusaders in the first place. So I'll start with a couple of just snippets from news articles, both from News Hub, our wonderful media conglomerate. The following quote states, historian Peter Lynham says the Crusaders' name shouldn't have been sanctioned for their debut in 1996. He says, alleged gunman Brenton Tarrant's manifesto refers to the Crusader ideology and references one of the darkest times in history. It invokes a history of genocide, and because of that name, it should never be on anybody's mind, Lynham told News Hub. And this particular bit of information from the Crusades is actually up for debate. So he goes, they claimed with glee that they made the streets run knee-high with blood. That's how gross a period it was. Just Peter Lynham needs to think about this for a minute. The amount of blood that you would need to be knee-high in blood, and like, what dimensions are we talking about here? Are we talking about like a large building? Are we talking about the streets? Because even if it was in a large building,
there'd be
a lot of blood. So it's just hyperbole from a historical perspective. He also went on to say a couple of days later, in the Muslim world, the word crusader has implications of a religious war by the West against the Muslim community. Basically, crusader is the Christian. See, they don't mind calling them Christians instead of Easter worshippers here. It is the Christian equivalent of jihad. And in both cases, it means bloody religious war. It is highly offensive. So we have to address these claims. Much like most people of the left-leaning persuasion, they are prepared to forget about context. So for the listeners out here, I'd just like to outline events prior to the First Crusade. The First Crusade happened in 1095 and was called by Pope Urban II. Prior to the First Crusade in 1095, there was about 400 years of Muslim expansion into North Africa and the Middle East and into Europe itself. So in the old Roman Empire of antiquity, it was divided into the Western and Eastern Roman Empires. It consisted of five major patriarchs. So patriarchs are essentially a state that's governed by a main city. The main cities were Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And by 661 AD, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria had all fallen. So these are bastions of Christian intellectual thought. They're also bastions of, say, for example, Egypt was a great producer of grain for the Christian world. Syria, which is linked into Jerusalem, was many of the original thinkers that came out of Christianity, not just theologically, but scientifically, were from Syria. So before the First Crusade eventuated, all of North Africa was taken. 90% of Spain was taken. All of the Middle East was taken, and Christians were either reduced to dhimmi status or basically purged from their ancestral homelands. And I've got some stats here. So Peter Lynham talked about rivers of blood in regards to the number of just Christians that were killed by Islam through this period and onwards. 60 million Christians were killed. So you can find this data from David B. Barrett, Todd M. Johnson, and it's from their study, The Christian World Trends from AD 30 to AD 2200. So they're obviously doing projections into what the Christian populace will be in the future. And that's from the William Carey Library in 2001. And that's a table 410. But, you know, Christians were the only people persecuted by Islamic invasion, and around 80 million Hindus were killed, 10 million Buddhists. But also, you know, we have to touch on, and if we're talking about absolute barbarity, it would have to be the enslavement of millions and millions of Africans. And I don't know how much reading of the Quran you've done, but there is a number.
I've read all of it.
Okay, yep, yeah. Well, it pays to, if you're going to criticize the Quran, you need to be
able to. That's what I recommend to people. I say, you want to know about Islam, read the Quran.
Yeah.
It's simple.
100%. And the accompanying hadith. So you've got to make the distinction that the hadiths aren't actually the Quran. The hadiths are kind of like a theological guidebook into interpreting the Quran scriptures.
Yeah, even more than that, they contain a lot of quotes that were also supposedly from Muhammad. So his followers said these were other things that Muhammad said to us.
Yeah, it's kind of supposed to be the Roman letters that we have in the Bible, essentially.
So it's not just commentary. It is also supposedly more actual words from Muhammad, more teachings from Muhammad that weren't part of what he claims to have been direct revelation.
Yeah, although Quranic apologists will often state that they don't adhere to the hadith. But most of the,
especially if we talk about the most famous Islamic reformer, you might call him Imam Tawhidi from Australia.
Yeah, awesome.
He outright rejects all of this stuff, so it is important to note that. Yeah. But I mean, the Quran itself contains plenty of.
Yeah, so just going back to the Africans, like 14 million Africans were sent to the Islamic nations as part of their conquests. You can find all this information. I mean, it's been documented by Thomas Sowell in his book Race and Culture. So if people aren't familiar with Thomas Sowell, he's an African-American academic and much loathed by the left. He's referred to as an Uncle Tom, but conversely much loved by the right for his measured and truly articulate, intelligent and thoughtful commentary on race and race issues.
But in many of these Islamic nations, to this day, you have African slavery continues.
Right? Yes.
There are more slaves in the world today than there ever have been in the history of the world. In terms of numeric value, not in terms of percentage. You're talking about the enslavement of Africans prior to the Crusades there.
Yeah.
That overall number today is likely higher.
So, I mean, this is the context that is missing from Peter Lynham's criticism. It's really just gushing and inflammatory, and it was I don't think he really thought about it like hard enough. He didn't really consider the full context of what happened in history. And you know, the Crusaders, I don't think people like think about brand name Crusaders and go, yeah, I'm gonna go out and kill me some Muslims or anything like that.
No, it's a bizarre claim to make.
Yeah.
You have to be, in a sense, deranged to be thinking that in the first place, to be making that association.
I didn't even think about the Crusades. I just saw a warrior who's armed, and like many, many rugby union sports teams and other sports teams, they pick warriors to represent the masculinity, the combativeness of the sport.
And a crusade, the Crusaders were used or deployed or fought elsewhere as well. They didn't only fight against the various caliphs. And in addition to that, the concept of crusading, I don't know if you're familiar with the American evangelical term of having a crusade. They still do. They still use that term today, I believe, some of them.
No, I wasn't familiar with that.
So they call it having a crusade, which is like some kind of religious evangelism that they do. They go out and do lots of street preaching or whatnot.
Yeah.
They actually call that crusading in terms of evangelizing. So it has a very wide range of usage. And the thing about going somewhere to specifically kill Muslims is the last thing on anybody's mind.
Yeah.
Unless you are weirdly warped in the way that Brendan Tarrant was.
Yep.
And
Brendan Tarrant.
And dare I say, some of these professors, so that's the first thing that pops into their head when they think of the word crusade.
Yeah, and really, you question the motivations, right? When someone just leaps to this straight away. And just in the terms of if we're going to hold certain types of warriors to account for deeds of the past, I mean, I've used this example before, the Waikato chiefs, like, for example, Tainui, which is one of the iwi there, went down and attacked the Taranaki iwi and took slaves, and that was during the Musket Wars. So when we're talking about slavery in New Zealand, well, actually the only slavery that occurred in New Zealand was from Māori extracting utu against other tribes, and they were used and incorporated in the harvesting of things like flax and timber spars, not specifically the Tainui region, but the Ngāpuhi region. So are we just going to make the chiefs change their name too? So And, you know, so and, where does this end?
Where does it end? You go on and on and on, right? Vikings were, you know, pillaged their way down the European coastline. Vikings being a popular sports team name as well. And we can say the Saracens who fought against the Crusaders.
Yep. And,
the
and there's a rugby team in England called the Saracens.
And there is a rugby team in the South Island called the Saracens. I believe it's quite a minor team. I saw somebody bring that up.
Yeah.
I'm not offended by that. Why would I be offended by somebody naming their team the Saracens?
Yeah.
They were historical people who were historical warriors, and that's what it is. I would never for a moment entertain that somebody who wanted to name their team the Saracens wants to murder Christians. Right? Yep. That would be an absurd thing to suggest. What are they naming? They're naming it after an interesting piece of history.
Yes, this is where it comes down to, really, is that you don't think that unless you come from a intersectional critique of names and classes, so to speak, or you know, positions of privilege.
And I'll stop you right there in terms of, because you mentioned intersectionality. I actually didn't know what that term meant until a few months ago, where Prager University did a video on this, and I would suggest you go and look that up. Just in YouTube, Prager University intersectionality, and they will explain to you what it means.
Yeah.
If it's the most bizarre thing ever.
Essentially, it's like an inverse hierarchy, so of oppression.
Yeah, that's so the more oppression points that you collect from being part of certain minority groups, so the more minority groups that you are part of, the greater your intersectionality score.
Yeah.
And
your intersectionality power.
Power is the word. And it's the most bizarre thing ever. Yeah. And like you said, that's what makes people think.
Yeah.
Like if they hear the word crusader, that's when they suddenly think of victimhood and oppression, who was oppressed. And no matter what you mention, that's their first go-to is who was oppressed.
And so just to rattle off a couple more stats in terms of the Islamic invasion into Persia, the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe, there were 580 battles alone fought in continental Europe, and there was roughly 12 crusades fought in the Middle East. It was essentially a defensive war. I suggest that people go in and do their own research on it. It's really all out there for people to read. Just in regards to papal dispensations. So people often scoff at papal dispensations, but if you read the history of crusades, the knights who were expected to lead these crusades had a fervent and deeply held belief in God and the teachings of the gospel that you were not to kill your enemy. So they actually had a mortal fear for their souls. And in order to exact any sort of defensive war on the nations of Islam, they had to seek papal dispensations in order to get these guys mobilized to go and take back the lands that had been conquered from Christians.
Something you mentioned there made me think of the another agency that we have that needs to change their name. St. John's Ambulances.
Yeah.
Where do St. John's Ambulances come from?
Knights Hospitaller.
The Crusaders. Right? Yeah. The St. John's was basically a regiment, or I'm not sure what term they would have used, but they were an auxiliary force of the Crusader arms. Yeah. That was sort of the foundation of field hospitals and so on, which carries on to this
all these
day.
Oppressive things.
So many, so horrible. So horrible. And I could bring up as well other points there. I mean, people argue about the religious motivations behind the war and so on. You did have some of the crusades were horrible disasters, right? The sacking of Constantinople.
Yeah,
the Fourth Crusade was specifically horrible. You had an attempted children's crusade, which John Black has actually written an article on Right Minds.
And there's also in the First Crusade preceding the amalgamation of the four main forces, there was a peasants' crusade that was launched from Germany. Unfortunately, they did kill about 5,000 Jews before they set off. But they marched through. They were literally peasants
and
with pitchforks.
This is why we're not saying the Crusaders were all wonderful, lovely people, and they were doing a wonderful, lovely thing. Yeah. It's just what they were doing. True, they have. I'm just about to bring up another German too. But what they were doing was not out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Historically speaking, they were not horrible. Like if we place all of the Crusaders and what they did in their historical context, what they did was not particularly out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Compared to today's standards, probably just about everything they did was horrible. But you can't go back and judge everybody by your standards of today, because then everybody's horrible.
Yeah. And you could make hierarchies of horribleness, and I think there's a strong argument that Islam would come out close to the top after Genghis Khan, perhaps.
If you want to make that hierarchy. And I'm We're not suggesting that you should make that hierarchy, but it's, again, it's these regressive professors who are making these hierarchies.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like what response are we going to have to this?
Yeah, you're going to come up with your own hierarchies. Mm. They're forcing you to come up with hierarchies.
Yeah, and they're creating more people like Brenton Tarrant.
Mm. You know, these professors are not really thinking, well, they probably are thinking through what they're doing, but they don't truly understand the implications of what they're doing.
Mm.
And, you know, the last German I was going to bring up was Martin Luther, who initially argued against the Crusades. Until there were more Islamic incursions into Europe, and he actually changed his mind slightly on that topic, and he wrote a book called On the War Against the Turk, and he actually kind of said, the church shouldn't be so involved in wars, but, like, war in and of itself is actually can serve a good purpose in a defense, you know, in a defensive fashion. So and so this whole concept of just war, as a casus belli, was actually formulated during the Crusades, that, hey, we need a rationale for war.
Yeah.
We're not just going to go out and pillage people for the fun of it.
And as a testament to how unbelievably, relatively speaking, I know, you know, Christianity historically hasn't been perfect, but how peaceful it is, relatively speaking, in order to launch a war, there's a bunch of processes that specific clergies had to go to in order to justify any even a form of defense, really.
Had to be justified.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm thinking that sort of wraps up our little discussion of the Crusades and the history of the Crusades. There is lots more to be said. There have been many books written on this subject,
but
I hope that the listeners found that informative.
Yeah, and piqued their interest. Go read some books. People, read books, educate yourselves on this stuff.
And history is fascinating. I love reading accounts of war, not because I love the war, but it makes you appreciate just how horrible war is.
Yeah.
And but
and how good it is now. And we should be grateful.
Exactly, that we don't have to live through this.
Yeah, and don't undermine what we have.
What we have, that's right. Because people gave, you know, so much blood has been shed to bring us to where we are.
Mm.
Don't throw it away, right? Yep. The people who are throwing this away, these professors from Massey University who want to throw this all away, what you're going to have is more bloodshed on the way down and a whole lot more bloodshed on the way up.
Yeah.
It's better to stay up here and avoid these future conflicts that they seem to be bringing back up, because they want to destroy history and set us back to year zero.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get back to year zero, well, then you've got to start again. And that includes all of the horrible things that we've, you know, that we have overcome as a civilization, that we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yep.
You get rid of the giants, you're going to have to build them back up from scratch.
They hate capitalism.
Mm.
Our whole world is dependent on capitalism functioning. These people are absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm. We could talk for hours on stuff like this. Like you said, we could switch this into...
Well, there's a bit of a segue I'd like to introduce, and I suppose it relates to another academic. It's because I thought if I was to come on every now and again to your podcast, I would like to introduce academics that are teaching our children in this country. And it's specifically, if you are religious-minded and you hold a faith and you study theology, these are some of the people that you're going to, your children potentially could come into contact with. And specifically, I thought I'd introduce Dr. Caroline Ann Blythe. And this is from the Auckland University page, so I'm not saying anything here that is untrue. She had a degree in psychology and worked in mental health. She had a fascination for religious studies that was ignited when she did her undergraduate degree. Since being awarded my doctorate in 2008, I've taught courses in biblical studies, biblical languages, and religious studies both at St. Andrews University and Edinburgh University. Here at the University of Auckland, I teach a range of courses which explore the complex relationships between religion and contemporary culture. I'm also involved in the School of Medicine's Medical Humanities program and teach a course in religion, spirituality, and health. And some of the research that she participates in is gender, violence, rape culture, and religion. Religion, gender, sexuality, representations of gender, sexuality, and the body through feminist and post-feminist lenses. Religion and art, film, and literature, and cultural studies in religion, the political potential of religious studies as a means of cultural critique and change. And, you know, this is the big one, critical theory and queer theories in cultural and religious studies. And for people who don't know, critical theory is essentially a Marxist-inspired academic study that was worked on in the Frankfurt School. And it's basically a hotbed of the worst anti-West, anti-capitalism, anti-Christian left-wing ideas that you could possibly imagine. And interestingly enough, Dr. Blythe is the editor on The Bible and Critical Theory. Ta-da! An online scholarly journal that publishes peer-reviewed articles that explore the intersections between critical theory and biblical studies. So these people...
I believe that intersection point is called hell.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, like, of all the wealth and depth, even if you're going to take a non-believer perspective on the Christian worldview and on the Christian scriptures and religious thought, I mean, this is what has made Dr. Jordan Peterson so popular, is he's been able to take the underlying truths of the Bible and the associated Christian worldview and bring out the wisdom and make it flourish and I hate to use this term, but appeal to a non-believer so they can actually see the value, the inherent value, and how it ties to us, our sense of the individual, but not just the celebration of the individual, but the sacrifice of the individual, like Christ, to sacrifice himself so you're not sacrificing others. Mm-hmm. And this is what has made the West great, that veneration of the individual and to sacrifice yourself as opposed to others.
Because that's the real big difference between Christianity, individualism and Christianity and individualism and postmodernism is the position of self. Right? Mm. Christianity is individual, but you are to self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. The process of the individual is self, is self-sacrificial. Mm. In postmodernism, the individual is elevated to the status of the divine.
And you sacrifice others.
That's right. And you yourself must be preserved at all costs.
Yeah.
And that's... there's that clash and there's that decline. And that's, like you said, that's something Jordan Peterson is able to bridge incredibly well and to drag people back from the abyss. That's the image he uses. I love this, the way that you've brought this around to what will be our next topic. We're going to have you back on really soon, maybe even in the next month or so. I've got a few other things planned and a few other guests planned as well. Next week, I hope to have Elliot Ikele from the New Conservative Party on. And if Jesse as well, he'll be back too. And when we have you back on, Oregon, we will definitely talk about theology professors. And I love this subject because my parents always said to me, said, if you want to become an atheist, study theology at university. And I think we will uncover some very deep truths about that if we were to delve down into what's going on at Auckland. At Auckland University specifically, but it'll be the theology departments at universities all around the country. And we can wrap this up with the usual bit of classical culture. And I think our discussions today here really have been around Western civilization and Western culture. And it would be great to wrap it up with a piece of music. This time, rather than me just picking my favorite composer over and over again, I have asked our guest, who's now been elevated to co-host, to give us a recommendation, and I will let you take it from here.
Yeah, so this is an aria from Giuseppe Verdi's opera Simon Boccanegra. The aria is called Il Lacerato Spirito, and it's sung by the character Fiesco, who has lost his daughter to pirates. His daughter has been slain, and he's overcome with grief, and he curses God, why would he take my daughter in this manner? He realizes he has blasphemed, and he asks God for forgiveness. I quite like this piece because it's quite grave, and it also expresses the love for a father and his daughter and the grief that's associated with it. I think it's quite a moving piece. And the intro, I think it starts, Tel estremo addio, Pelagio altero, Fredo sepolcro, dell'angio la mio, which is roughly translates to, this is our final goodbye to the lofty palace, the cold tomb of my angel. So here we go.
Well, thank you very much. I will just play the first minute or so of that piece, and I would strongly encourage you to go and listen and watch the whole thing on Spotify and YouTube. If you just search for Verdi Il Sacramento Spirito, you will see... I botched that really bad.
Il Lacerato Spirito.
My Italian accent is terrible, and I'm not going to fake one. If you look in the description of the video, or if you look on the website where the podcast is, you can just copy-paste it. Yeah. And The thing I find about opera is it's not something you really just listen to in the background. It's something that takes a lot of your focus. Some people hate opera, and it's because to really appreciate it, you've got to sit down and you've got to focus it. You can't multitask. Mm. You really have to pay attention to it. Then you will enjoy it. I guarantee it, you will enjoy opera. And Verdi, one of the best.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the greatest.
So that's all for today. Thank you very much, Oregon. Everyone, please enjoy the music and the podcast. We'll be back next week.
Goodbye for now. Thank you.